Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Michael Pallett will be speaking on blind or visionary leadership based on 10th chapter of Mark. So let's listen in on Michael.
We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 52. And again, our focus for this week's Bible study is to try to come to some understandings about what Mark wants to tell us about discipleship, and that understanding of what being a follower of Jesus, what being a disciple of Jesus is all about. And we're in the section now of where Jesus is going to Jerusalem. He's on the way. So we could say switching from one room to another is a nice object lesson of how we too are always on the way, never quite sure which room we'll be in next, right? So we're on the way, and we have gone through two passion predictions already in chapter 8 and in chapter 9. And now here in chapter 10, we're going to be looking at Jesus' third passion prediction. Again, the disciples' misunderstanding of that, and then Jesus' teaching on discipleship and what that means. And as we go on in Mark's gospel, he seems to characterize the 12 disciples as getting stupider and stupider. As each passion prediction comes along, they just seem to get more and more dense, more and more misunderstanding. And Mark tips us off to that at the very beginning. In chapter 10, verse 32, we see all sorts of key words for Mark here. I'm reading here again from a New Revised Standard Version, but let me note these key words, right? They were on the road. On the road. In Greek, exodus. Exodus. So in the very, very beginning again, we've got one of Mark's key models and metaphors, right? Exodus, because as discipleship people, as followers of Jesus, we are always on an exodus. Just like Israel was leaving Egypt, that land of bondage and slavery, toward the promised land, so we too, as followers of Jesus, are on that exodus from slavery to promise, to freedom. So, on the way, going up to Jerusalem, Jesus was walking ahead of them. And again, there's all sorts of understandings about this. That first of all, one can say, all right, physically, Jesus is walking ahead of them. Secondly, that's a model of discipleship. Jesus is the leader. We are the followers, so that Jesus is walking ahead of us, walking where we soon will walk, where we must follow. But also, in that sense, walking ahead of them, that Jesus is way ahead of the disciples in understanding who God is and what God is all about and what discipleship is all about. Remember, Jesus is way ahead of them because obviously he understands that to be the Christ means that the cross is an integral part of that. And we as the smart disciples reading this text also know that to be a follower of Jesus, to be a follower of the Christ, somehow means that the cross is an integral part of that. We may not always know exactly what that entails, but we know that the cross has got to be in there. And so we're reading this text to see how that cross is in there and what we can learn from that and how Mark challenges us. The disciples, again, are characterized. They still haven't caught on that the cross is part of this. All right, that's how stupid they are. And we'll see this in just a second. They're walking ahead of them, They were amazed. And they've been amazed all along. They've been amazed because whether Jesus is teaching or doing miracles or whatever, they're always asking the question out of amazement, you know, what's he doing? Or what's he going to do now? You know, what's going on here? And as well, in their amazement, they're always asking that question, who is he? Who is this guy? Kind of like, it dates me, in the early TV days, right? Remember the old Lone Ranger series, and the Lone Ranger goes around and he does all these wonderful deeds and everything, and then at the very end of the show, somebody, you know, a stupid disciple, asks, who was that masked man? Well, that's kind of what these folks are doing. The disciples are always in amazement when these teachings and healings and other miracles are, they're always like, who is this masked man? And in a sense, Jesus is masked in that understanding of the cross is still masked from them. They don't understand that. Despite the fact, right, that this is going to be the third time he wants them to confront that. And those who followed, okay, this is at least the one good thing that Mark has to say about the 12 disciples, is, right, they keep following. They don't understand what's going on. They're still amazed, and they keep asking questions that should have been answered and understood long ago. But somehow, despite all of that, to their credit, they're still following. An encouragement to us as well, I think, right? That we may not always understand, we may not have the answers. We too might be asking, what's going on? What is God doing? And the thing is, well, we may find that out as we keep on the road. But the encouragement there is, disciples, amidst your perplexities, amazements, questionings, right, keep on following. Right, that whatever else a follower of Jesus does, that does define them. They keep on following. But, right, those who followed were afraid. And so here again, Mark is going to set out the contrast between fearful and faithful discipleship. The faithful discipleship, as we'll see in the end, will come again with the healing of a blind man, with the healing of blind Bart, right? Blind Bartimaeus. That's where Mark will finally give us kind of the ideal type of disciple. And again, the irony there is, if you want to find out who is the ideal disciple in Mark's gospel, don't look to Rocky Johnson, look to Blind Bart. Kind of reads like a Western, doesn't it? Rocky Johnson and Blind Bart and all that. Mark wants us to read it that way, I'm convinced. Bartimaeus is the example of faithful discipleship. The 12 are exemplars of fearful discipleship. And we'll see that understanding of how fearful discipleship comes through again in the way they respond to the passion predictions. Okay, the last sentence in verse 32. Jesus took the 12 aside again. Okay, so we've just got the 12 here. And for the last time, and again, began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Then they will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, spit upon him, and flog him, and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise again. As we go along with each passion prediction, Jesus becomes more and more specific. And as we go along, the disciples become more and more dense. That the clearer Jesus is, the more obfuscated the disciples are. Here Jesus is so clear that we have here basically in outline form the scenario of the action of what happens in chapters 14 and 15 of Mark's Gospel. That in some senses here, in these two verses, we have the whole summary of the last three chapters of Mark's Gospel, right? This is his outline. He's detailing for us specifically what's going to happen. And again, think about it, right? That we've got this tremendously heavy stuff, right? Condemn him to death. Hand him over or betray him to the Gentiles. Mock, spit, flog, kill, right? And in the midst of all of those heavy words, now here comes James and John, right? Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you, right? I mean, these guys are just stupid, right? I mean, would that be the first question that comes to your mind after you've just heard Jesus say, I'm going to be condemned to death, betrayed, mocked, spit upon, beaten up, killed? And you say, oh, by the way, Jesus, would you write us a blank check? But that's what they're asking, right? The contrast there is they just don't get it. They just don't get it. They want this blank check. We want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Contrast this to what Jesus would say a disciple wants. Back to chapter 9, verse 35. This is the second passion prediction. So there's also here again a contrast between 9:35 and 10:35, right? But in terms of, let's say, right, James and John want, and Jesus here saying, in this sense, what a true disciple wants. And here it is, verse 35 of chapter 9. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. Right. So what a true disciple wants is this sense of last, servant. That's being first in God's reign and rule. James and John, as we see, what they want is the exact opposite. They want first. They want glory. We'll see how the verse 36, right? Jesus kind of plays along, right? Well, what is it you want me to do for you? And they said to him, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. The contrast here again, Jesus has been talking about a cross. All they can think about is glory. To kind of use that George Bush phrase, James and John and the other disciples are smart enough to figure out that with Jesus there is a new world order. But in this new world order, they want to be first. They haven't understood that this new world order means a cross. They think it means glory. They think it means power, control. They're in charge. Everybody else now is going to have to do what they want to do. In terms of Lutheran theology, it would be Luther's contrast between Jesus, who is preaching and proclaiming a theology of the cross, and the disciples, who are preaching and proclaiming a theology of glory, a theology of glory that ends in triumphalism. That what they're concerned about is triumphing. Winning. We're number one. We're first. Everybody's going to bow down to us. Right? We want that kind of understanding. Of course, as well, Mark has the irony here that we understand that for Christ, right, the cross is Christ's glory. Because the cross is the way in which God is at work lovingly and salvifically in the world for us and for all creation and for all people. And again, that's the kind of thing James and John just don't get it. But they're stupid disciples. We're the smart disciples. We're supposed to get that. So again, Jesus continues to work with them and say, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They replied, we are able. And again, in Greek, it's just one word, kind of transliterate. Jesus, I said, well, do you think you can do all of this stuff? And they replied, can do. Right? Dinas thing, right? Can do. We can do it. No problemo. Right? Can do. That utter confidence, right? You see this sense again. The glory and triumphalism, and then we see the misunderstanding of John and James just oozing out here, right? Can do. They're like, this is no problem. The other thing, just gonna an aside here a little bit. The understanding of cup and baptism. Certainly if we look at this text and want to think about it theologically, we can see that the images of cup and the images of baptism can lead us into sacramental theology. That the cup can be talking about the Lord's Supper and baptism about the sacrament of baptism. But Mark isn't trying to do sacramental theology here at this time. The cup and baptism are just simply two metaphors, two images for participation, for that sense of following. Again, Jesus asking, do you think you really can participate in what I'm going to have to participate in? Do you really think you can follow through with this in your following? Again, in terms of imagery, the cup is a sign of fellowship, of covenant. Right? We still have the custom today, let's say, when a significant treaty is signed, at the end of signing the treaty, right, you may have a toast, right, raise a cup, glass of champagne, or whatever. It's the way, again, of symbolizing two sides now participate in something together. Right? That's an old, old, old tradition that, you know, raising a cup, having a toast, signifies, ratifies a treaty, a sense of participation. Baptism has that same sense of participation and initiation. Not only did Christians practice baptism, there were baptismal practices among Jews, there were baptismal practices, certain kinds of sacred washings among many of the different Greco-Roman religions at the time as well. So that here, the sense of baptism and the cup is just pushing this issue, you know, can you truly follow through? Can you participate? And again, their confidence, can do. That sense of all of that is there. Jesus then responds to them in a much more kind of predictive understanding, right? That says, the cup that I drink, you will drink. And with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. In other words, even Jesus himself here is saying that when you understand who I am as Christ and cross and what participation means, that is still always on the way kinds of discipleship. who's going to be first, who's going to be last, that's not mine to grant. That's not what I give. What I give, what I enable people to do, what I am about is helping people follow, to be on the road, to continue the journey, to participate in that and all that that entails. That's what he is about.
Right.
That's simply what James and John do not understand. Total misunderstanding here. They've missed it entirely. They've missed that disciples are to be the last, the least, the servant. They want to be first, on and on. So given that misunderstanding, in verses 41 through 45, we now again have a teachable moment. Given that they've misunderstood, we as the smart disciples know that they've misunderstood, right? They've really missed the boat. I mean, it isn't that they're getting C minuses in discipleship. They're getting Fs, straight Fs, right? Low grade point average here. But it's still time to teach. Verse 41, when the 10 heard this, they began to be angry with James and John. The word there for angry could also be indignant, and it reflects that there's of course angry at James and John, but they're also angry at themselves. What Mark wants to say here is that it's not just James and John that misunderstood. The other 10 are angry because they're going, oh, see? Why didn't we ask that? Right? I mean, they're mad that James and John asked that, but more so, they're angry and mad because, gee, why didn't we ask to be first? What's the matter with me? How could I have been so stupid? Right? You've probably had those kinds of situations. Right? That you're angry, but you're really more angry at yourself because somebody else did what you really wanted to do. And so you're mad at them, but you're also mad at yourself. That's the situation here, right? Mark, again, wants to include all the disciples to say, right, this is the characteristic that in that sense of discipleship, we so often always want to be first, be in charge, have that sense of authority and leadership. So now that we've got all of the disciples stupid and angry, now we're ready for a real teachable moment. So Jesus called them and said to them, you know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. Okay, lord it over has here a notion of dominating, right? That these folks dominate. Are tyrants over, it's older translations might have, and this is again a more literal sense. I mean, tyrants do this. They have authority over, but it's that notion of having authority, and the reason that they're tyrants is that they subjugate. And so Jesus is saying, well, you know the Gentile kind of leadership. And now keep in mind, who are we thinking about here for Gentiles? Well, two of their closest friends that everybody in Judea at the time loves, right? Caesar and Pilate, right? I mean, those imperialistic Romans are in there, and we know how the Romans operate. Right? They operate through means of domination and subjugation. The prefix in Greek, kata, means down. And I think to play with that a little bit, you could almost say that the prefix in terms of that is saying that the way the Gentiles work is they operate with put down authority. What is the kind of power, control, management necessary to put people down and keep them down? Right, it's what we're all familiar with in terms of, right, the pyramid style, Right? Here's Caesar, here's Pilate. The authority they exercise is always put down, keep down authority. Keep them down. And again, the kind of irony that's being oozed here about saying, well, James and John, so you want to act and you want to have authority the way the Gentiles do. And also remember in this context, you know, Gentiles is a dirty word, right? So that when you say Gentiles, it's the kind of thing, you know that among the Gentiles, the kind of authority they exercise. I'd be glad I didn't spit straight. Right? But I mean, that's kind of, I mean, spit when you say Goyim. Right? Spit when you say Romans. Right? Imperialistic, blood-sucking Romans. Right? And so, what we see, the irony here is saying, isn't it incredible that James and John following Jesus, right? I mean, you can see the cross is out of the picture. That James and John really don't want a new world order at all. What they really want is simply to be the folks in charge of the old world order. Right? What they don't like is that it's folks like Caesar and Pilate that put them down. And so what they want to have is just say, well, now it's our turn to put down Caesar and Pilate. Right? Let's just change the pyramid around a little bit. And who's at the top of the pyramid? James and John. And now everything's okay in the world. If you were here yesterday afternoon with Fred Niedner's Bible study. I mean, that was his thing, that, you know, there's that kind of literature within both Hebrew scriptures and sometimes the New Testament, which says, you know, oh God, we wish now that you are on our side, that you will bring in the time of tremendous feasting and we can have the best wine possible and life is so good. And as for our enemies, may they spend the rest of their lives in the latrine. May they be doomed to garbology forever, right? You know, what does, and Fred said, isn't that kind of problematic, right? Is that really what we wish? Is that what we understand the Christian message to be and what Jesus is all about? That it's just that kind of, you know, reversal so that those who are up are now down and those who are down are now up? You see, the thing here is what James and John don't recognize is that this doesn't change anything. The structure is the same. And Jesus' understanding of discipleship, Jesus linking up with the cross and a theology of the cross, again, Mark pushes that is so radical that it shatters this kind of structuring. This isn't the way that followers of Jesus live in the world. This is not the way followers of Jesus treat one another. And even more shocking, this is not the way followers of Jesus treat anyone else in the world either. Why would they engage in this kind of understanding? Well, let me speculate a little bit here. Remember, they're following out of fear. And it seems to me Mark is telling us a discipleship of fear uses this kind of structure. Because a discipleship of fear needs to have control. You're afraid of everybody else. So what do you do when you're afraid of them? You control them. And one of the best ways you control folks is to exclude them and to put them down and keep them down. Maybe this is the point to stop to say, think about your own congregational structuring, synodical structuring, national church structuring. Do we still operate this way? Or is it a structuring, maybe that's not a pyramid, but that it's some kind of structuring, a structuring that models a discipleship of fear? Again, the kind of question that says, if we look at the way we organize ourselves and structure ourselves and what that means for the treatment of people both in our church and outside of our church, and probably more importantly, outside of our church, to ask the question, what are you afraid of that you have to structure yourself that way? Let me, as a Lutheran, ask that question to non-Lutheran folks, because that's always safer, right? Because then we can always say, chief of sinners though we be, everyone else is worse than we. So those are always the fun questions to ask, right? So we can ask, for example, Roman Catholics in their position on the ordination of women, what are you afraid of if you're going to ordain women? What's that all about? But now let's turn it back in on ourselves and look at that, you know, harmless, innocuous statement on sexuality that the ELCA tried to get out and tried to talk about homosexuality and other issues, and the kind of thing to say, what are you afraid of if we start talking about sexuality and homosexuality and gay, lesbian people, and lifestyles, and orientation? Why is that, at that point, why the heavy-handed structuring and control and authoritarianism and the excluding and the putting down? I'm not even starting to talk yet about answers and looking at that. All I'm saying is maybe before we can even address that issue, we have to ask ourselves the question, what are we afraid of? Because that's what's hindering our discipleship at that point. Why are we so afraid? Or, Mary is here, multicultural issues in that. Why do we structure things in certain ways that, again, right, we can control, and certain people are in and certain people are out? What are we afraid of? And is it the case that most of the times, our church models of structure and authority model discipleship of fear, not discipleship of faithfulness? That we too, like James and John, are fearful followers, not faithful followers. Let me just pose the alternative, and then I want to open that for your reflections and your comments. We know what the Gentiles do now, right? A very stark contrast, right? Verse 40. But it is not so among you. I mean, straight, hard declarative there is, you know, we're going to make sure there's a clear demarcation between that, right? What is faithful discipleship? What is Jesus' vision of leadership and authority? It's what? Whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Following Jesus, faithful following when it comes to visions of leadership and authority, is ransom following. Now, ransom here within the context is that one at times can, right, you can ransom someone from prison. Right? Someone is guilty of a crime, they've been convicted, but you could still ransom them. Right? Pay appropriate monies, damages, whatever, they can be ransomed. Or you can ransom someone from slavery. You can buy their freedom, and then they will truly be free and no longer susceptible to slavery. So that understanding of ransom leadership and authority is a notion of deliverance, is a notion of freedom. so that Christian discipleship works with people and structures their leadership and authority. Not that we put people down, but that we free them up. Or we could even say we lift them up. Christian authority and leadership lifts up people. Or a word that we use so often nowadays, but I think is appropriate in this context, is it empowers. This kind of authority and leadership, right, disempowers, to make up a word, right? It takes away power that people have, abilities, capacities, keeps them down, put them. This lifts up, frees up, empowers them, because it's not afraid of who they are and what they do. Because again, following Jesus does not operate out of that sense of fear. And so therefore, its structuring would not be a fearful kind of structuring, but a structuring that is deliberate, right? And again, another word for deliver. Liberating. Freeing. Lifting up. Empower. Let me just stop there for your comments, questions.
Just a quick one. When Jesus talks about this new structure here, the one thing that's a little problematic for me is he's still, though, using, you know, the least and greatest kind of language. He's still using the old order kind of language. You know, you must be least. It sounds like all he's saying is your position on the pyramid changes. Whereas you're using empowering. I mean, I can see in ransom where we get that. But in the previous verse, that's still problematic for me.
Yes, but I think if you're right. We run that risk if we misunderstand what Jesus means by the least, is to say, well, to be like the least means be a doormat and have everybody wipe their feet on you. I don't think that's what Jesus is saying, because that would basically say, you know, volunteer to be bottom in the structure and have everybody stomp you down. No. But that understanding there is to say, to be the least is that sense of the willingness to be with and be among those who are voiceless, those who are powerless, because in so doing, you give them voice and power. Again, it's that sense of being with them, accompanying, right? I mean, here again, what Mark will get us to, right? We're not there yet. It's a good question at this point, even for a smart disciple to ask, say, well, now exactly how does that work? And we don't know, because that's what's going to happen yet in chapters 14 and 15 and 16. But we do know, right, that being the least, going to the cross, which certainly seems to be where you would be the most voiceless and powerless and down on the bottom. And on the one hand, yes, it is. But the irony and the paradox at all of that is it's precisely at that point where the greatest power, the loudest voice, the most forceful way of being with others is shown. Right? I mean, it's at the cross that the centurion says, this was the Son of God. Right? In that sense, Jesus, in all his godly power, is made clear at the cross. Right? So we haven't gotten to all, but yeah, least does not mean doormat. It does not mean perpetuating this kind of system.
I think, you know, the irony is that Christ was not choosing to go the power route, the worldly power route, the pilot power route, and yet he was crucified. So he was very threatening by the actions he did, the teachings he gave, the people identified with. He was threatening to the power structure, even though he was not attempting to achieve that kind of power.
And again, right, I mean, well, that's the worst kind of threat. I mean, you know, you can see why Caesar and Pilate, I mean, I mean, what happens if all of a sudden people start believing this Jesus guy and start structuring things differently? I mean, what does that mean for us?
No more pyramid.
No more pyramid. Bad news.
So giving up, you acquire. Mm-hmm. But it's rooted in a belief in God and in God's presence with you. Powerless.
But it's also, as Mark would say, it's precisely this following of discipleship, it's precisely this way of the cross that is going to put us into direct conflict with the power structures that are around us. They're not going to like it. And they will go to whatever lengths are necessary to get rid of the alternative. I mean, we see that in Jesus' day, within our own days, more dramatically. We see that in what's happening in many of the countries of the two-thirds world, right? Particularly, say, something like Latin America. Those of you who were fortunate enough to be here last week and listen to Bishop Medardo Gomez, the Lutheran bishop from El Salvador, right? I mean, would be saying, yeah, I understand this stuff very well. That's what's happening in El Salvador, right? The folks in the pyramid don't want to give it up. And when the church says there is a more excellent way of being in the world, they start killing people in the church. Priests and catechists and Bible study leaders who might get people to think about this and alternatives are traitorous subversives to the government. They gotta go. Assassinations, disappeared, imprisonment, right? I mean, this is politically subversive material that we've just read. You could be advocating the overthrow of our government, your government. I'm safe now. No, I'm still a U.S. citizen as well. A joint citizen, U.S. Canadian. There was a comment or question over here? No? Anyone else want to say something about this? Let's put just a little bit. What about what's going on in the church? If we would talk about getting rid of the pyramid, getting rid of that whole theology of glory and triumphalism in the way we run our congregations, synods, national church bodies, would that get you into trouble? Things are going that well out there? Wow! I'm amazed! What's going on here?
Well, you can take the Missouri Synod and Seminex. Here's one body that split up. I basically feel that it had a lot to do with the power struggle of two men wanting to have the authority.
Yeah, there was a lot of power going on there with folks. Yes, please.
I think there's always the struggle between the clergy and the laity. And I just read, and I don't remember whether it was in the Lutheran or one of the other publications, somebody said that we worked, those of us who are lay, worked hard on the ministry of the laity. And saying, well, maybe we hadn't ought to use that title. Maybe just ordained clergy should be in the ministry. Now, this is not true all over, but I think this is always a feeling of a struggle for power.
And we would certainly see that in terms of those old kinds of images, right, where the pastor was looked upon as Herr Pastor, yeah. Right? I mean, that was a good pyramid model for us, and we're trying to, right, get away from those kinds of Herr Pastor models.
Yeah, and I've worked a lot in the Synod, and I think that you can get the same kind of picture. I think I worked with two wonderful bishops, but I'm sure there are some people in the Synod who think too that that's a power shift.
What about that church structure that we might have in terms of not just how it works for those of us who are inside of the church, but what about that power structure with regard to those outside? I mean, how accessible, I mean, what kind of visionary leadership, what kind of faithful authority and following do we exercise or do we show to the folks who aren't, right? Members of our congregation or to folks who aren't ELCA or ELCIC. I mean, do we come across to outsiders, if you will, in that pyramid kind of model? I mean, again, here, I think part of the radicality of Mark's gospel is if that leadership is a ransom kind of leadership, a liberating, freeing, lifting up leadership, right? It's not there that we're just kind of in there lifting up one another. It's not to say, okay, well, for all of us who are caught inside the pyramid, let's see if we can level things out. But it's the kind of thing to say, how do we make sure that we don't act like a top part of a pyramid to other folks around us?
Yeah, I think that's a problem probably in most congregations. I'm sure it is in ours. We have declining membership. But there are a lot of Moabites and Hittites and people like that living in our neighborhood. But we don't welcome them in our congregation.
Because somehow it's still, you've got to fit our structure, our rules, and the kind of thing. Is that really genuine notions that, you know, there's, or is it just our way again of control, of fearfulness? I mean, you know, what happens if those people would take over?
Not present the congregation.
Yeah, that's right. Not the dreaded those people. And you know who they are. I mean, it's even interesting that so often we can't even name them or don't want. I mean, it's, you know, how low are they on our pyramids? They're nameless. Right? We're not even willing to give them a name. We put them in the sub-basement of the pyramid.
And education, the lowest of the low scum has been the teachers. And up until recently, with the restructuring of education, teachers now are starting to be given the authority. Restructuring for many school districts means that the principal becomes a servant leader, removing obstacles for the teachers to use their talents and their expertise
And that's right. I mean, it's good you brought up that. I mean, right, another point here that Mark is telling us is that what? Servant leadership is not an oxymoron. Right? Servant leadership is not self-contradictory. Right? That there is faithful following entails a servant leadership. And that is a viable way of being church, of being followers of Jesus. And so the challenge, I think, here for Mark is to get us to think about what that servant leadership is all about and how do we exercise that and practice it.
I'm struck in all of this by the thought that a lot of that power stuff comes about from poor choice making, and how difficult that really is to give people enough information in a way that they really can accept it and utilize it and make an informed choice and then accept the decision that comes out of that. And in this case, it seemed like Christ at his best was trying to give them an informed choice about discipleship. And yet your term stupid disciple, you know, they still didn't get it no matter how he presented the message. They were still left not understanding. They were making choices, sort of blind choices, because they didn't understand. And sometimes I think that the triangle, you know, we start out thinking we're going to have a circle. Everybody's going to be equal in the decision-making process. But because we're stupid, the people who have the most information and the greatest understanding then seem to automatically turn this into a triangle. And I think that the challenge always is, how do we keep giving enough information to keep the sides round?
Yeah, because that knowledge is power. Yeah. And why? I mean, we've got other teachers back. While Diane and Mary back there are teaching sessions precisely on, right, communication and that the sensitivity towards others, multiculturally, issues of racism, because, I mean, you know, racism works because this pyramid is the way we put things together. And so they help us, again, to understand some of these things. You know, knowledge is power. So how do we communicate? And how do we have knowledge in such a way that, again, right, liberates and lifts up people, not puts them down, right? I mean, keeping us in a circle or not, you know, high up. Or right now, the key metaphor for this kind of power structure, at least economically, pyramids are out, champagne glasses are in. Yeah, and it's all due to the this is an aside, but it's a teachable moment, right? It's due to the 1993 UN report on human development, where it charts how the money in the world is using, and the chart nicely works out to, you can see I'm a good artist here, to a champagne glass, and more of the wealth is concentrated in less and less folk, right? I mean, so we're getting a longer and a narrower stem with a more and more shallow glass. This was the graph on the front cover of the book. And, you know, again, it's been one of those little images that have caught on to say, and indeed, this is kind of the model of leadership, economically speaking, in terms of a few have a lot of the power, a lot of the goodies, and everybody else is just that very narrow, weak, fragile stem that can easily be snapped. Right? That's the economic picture of our world today. And since in our world today, economics, more than anything else, constitutes power, they're saying that's the picture of power in our world today. So that's just right. To show.
One of the things I think is that it's easy to sit here and talk about this theoretically, and you can bring up things like communication and ways to change, but I really challenge, we don't want to do that. Because as soon as we start linking this to practice, to how it affects our lives on a day-to-day basis, who really is in our church, who really we do have to sit next to, then people aren't interested. This is fine because it's distant. We're talking about abstract. We do not want to really make changes. This makes us feel good because at least it's opening up. We don't really want someone in our church who is so physically challenged that we might have to look at changing our physical plan to include that person on that level.
Yeah. I'd like to follow through with a bit of what Mary just said, because I came late yesterday and got into the middle of this discussion, and now we're proceeding this way. Myself, this seems real good from a theoretical standpoint, but how do I apply this to my life now as a retired engineer? How should I have applied it when I was active in the field? And I'm still at a loss. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be discussing this. This is theology, and theology is absolutely necessary if life is to continue on this earth. But we've got to go farther than discussing theology. We've got to take that theology and apply it to how we live our life out in the world. And I think that's what Mary was getting into. And I think it's important. And Holden Village tried to do that when we were here on staff. And that is why it was organized in the beginning. And I think we're still trying to do it. I'm hopeful, and I'm going to be here for, as it turned out, I arrived Monday, and we'll leave Monday, so we'll be here for. But that's one of the things that I'm very much interested in, is how is Holden Village continuing to take theology and discussing theology in the abstract, and how do we apply it to our everyday life?
I see the Lutheran Church continually keeping ourselves in a Scandinavian ghetto, if you will. I'm from California and grew up without any real awareness of whether or not what my ethnic background was, except I knew there were people of other colors in the place where I lived. When I went to seminary at Luther, I got so tired of all the Norwegian jokes and the smorgasbords and all the focus on that. When we're talking about needing to expand our mission field, reaching out to the people we don't want in our community, or that we do want in our community, but then we exclude them by the way that we socialize. Let's share a Norwegian joke, so I'm thinking, maybe we need to forget about that and find a new way for us to share our social life.
Part of my session actually today is going to be about Ties of Wonderfully, but inclusiveness and how do we, through our language, begin that process. So, cool advertising.
There was a comment over here, I think. Again, no? Someone over here wanted to say something? Yes, please.
It's not just within a church, within a church, whatever. It's society. When you put that champagne glass up there, a lot of us are very middle class. I'm in social services. I direct women's social services. I climbed the ladder to be a director, and therefore I got a certain income. Middle class. It's very difficult in this situation to understand and to empathize with and so forth the people who are not in that upper echelon. The people who are homeless, the people with AIDS, the people who are migrant workers. These are the people Christ walked over, and that's why he showed us the cross. I find it very difficult, even though I work in the field, to have empathy with, because I socialize with a lot of middle class folks. So I can imagine how difficult it is for people who don't work in the field to empathize with. Take somebody that owns a car dealership. And I know folks like this. It's a totally different environment. Culturally, a tremendous gap. Talk a different language, think different concepts, different structures. How do you empathize with folks that are at the bottom? The Bishop Gomez folks, or the people down here in the apple orchards and so on. And this is the challenge I see Jesus as giving us. And to close that cultural gap, whether it's in the church or out of the church, and I don't think Christ is saying it's bad to have money, but it's difficult to live the gospel. That's what he's saying.
And what I think he's talking about, too, is naming the fear. Because the difficulty isn't just because you don't know how. Because you certainly have the communication skills and the ability. It isn't that anyone in this room doesn't have the ability. But it's, I'm afraid.
To go meet that person.
Absolutely. And I'm afraid to let the people who watch me see me do that. I think that that's a piece, too.
But I think it's more a fear of what is it that I have to give up in order to be able to understand somebody else. I mean, I don't think we're willing to give up.
What do we have to give up?
Well, we first of all have to give up the fear. And if we get rid of all these things that define us, that we weren't going to be defined anymore. I mean, we have to start. I mean, I can really understand. I mean, I'm in a similar situation than you. And I feel like my greatest challenge is to figure out how to begin to give up those things that define me as a professional social worker, making good money in a community. I have to start stripping away those things that don't mean anything to who I am as a human being, because they have distanced me from people. They've made me richer in my life today, but they haven't made me richer in my soul. And I think that that's a process, and I think we're afraid. I mean,